Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, the 2018 midterm elections had a little bit of everything. The number of ads that were run was unprecedented. The money that was spent was in the tens of millions of dollars just to turn Florida red or blue. And one race you didn't get as much from was Congressional District 27. That seat was left behind by Ileana Ross-Leighton. Why was that race not getting as much attention? Well, for one, the debates were in Spanish. But Donna Shalala, former Health and Human Services Secretary and President of the University of Miami, defeated Republican Maria Alvarez Salazar. The Congresswoman-elect joins us now. And if you've got a question for her, what are some of the big goals you'd like to see her tackle when she gets into office in January? What are some of the big questions you have? We'd love to hear from you. 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. You can also post your question on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundog. Congresswoman-elect Shalala, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
By the way, congratulations on the victory. But I have to ask you, I mean, it's not that there wasn't any attention on your race. It's just that, we had a governor's race, the Senate race, then we had the recount. So we had all of these things going on, and it seemed like your race wasn't getting as much attention. That and the fact that you were doing debates in Spanish. Well, how did you do it?
Well, first of all, I did debates in Spanish out of respect for the community. I offered to do debates in English, and she kept turning me down until the end of the campaign when she decided, well, maybe we should debate in English. And I said, the heck with that. Let's move on. But there was no question that we did a lot of television and radio, and we were asked a lot of questions by both the public. We did town meetings. I mean, I went every place. The fact that we didn't get as much attention as the other races, that was fine with me because I was out talking to people and answering their questions and going to community meetings and, more importantly, going into people's homes. We hit, I didn't personally do it, 100,000 homes going door to door. And I was in the senior citizen centers, in large events. And of course, we had lots of debates during the primary. So people had an opportunity to hear my views.
It speaks to how different Miami is. I mean, it was a seat that was owned by a Republican
for 30 years.
And this is an area, though, that went to Hillary Clinton. So what do you think it is? What was it that the voters, why did they decide, yeah, let's go a different direction?
Well, first of all, it was a local race. I kept saying to people, stop looking at Hillary's numbers. I could have beaten Donald Trump by those numbers in this district. He was so unpopular. It's a local race. It's about local issues. It's about traffic. It's about gun control. It's about immigration because of who our population is. And 100,000 people that have Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, have their insurance, the largest enrollment of any congressional district in the country. So these were issues, these were bread and butter issues in many cases, and that's what I ran on. I didn't pretend that this was some national election, even though I associated my opponent without attacking her personally, because I just won't do that. I associated her with Donald Trump.
Again, the number is 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. What is your question for the Congresswoman-elect? Again, the new congressional leaders will be taking their positions in early January. What are some of the things that you hope this new Congress is going to be tackling? What are some of the things you think are most important for us? And you know what? If you voted in this past election, hopefully you did. But if you did, what were the big issues for you? As you heard her say, what were really the big things that the voters seem to be talking about most? Again, 800-743-9576. Before we go to the phones, I wanted to get to, I'm going to try to tackle a lot of different things here, but I wanted to get your take on what did happen afterwards. Your race was not contested afterwards in this recount, but Florida once again makes national news with the recount. Broward County, Palm Beach County. Now we have the governor replacing Brenda Snipes. She's now rescinded her her resignation, but a lot of attention for the state, not so positive. Do you have faith in our system here?
Well, I have faith in American democracy. On the technical part of whether we can handle elections or not, look at Miami-Dade. We did a really good job. The mayor appointed a very good person who is highly professional. The problem is that these elections are handled locally. The technology, how the ballot is organized, are handled locally. and with a lot of volunteers, and without modern technology in many cases. And you make a decision within your county or within your district what kind of technology you're going to use and how much money you're going to spend. You know, that's kindergarten stuff. This is not rocket science. Every state, there are states that are very progressive and have figured out how to do this. And it has to be a priority. Voting rights ought to be a priority in every state, but particularly in Florida. Look at one of the things we did. We did vote to allow people who had been convicted and served their time to vote, hopefully in the next election. So there certainly were some progressive elements. I just think we got to get our act together. And that starts with the governor making a decision that we're going to be the most progressive state in terms of the technology of voting.
And you were talking about Amendment 4, which passed overwhelmingly, giving former felons, many of them, their right to vote. By the way, just to mention, that's a segment we're going to talk about after you, is we're going to talk about how that works and how those folks are going to get their rights back. Let's go to the phones. And again, what's your question for the Congresswoman-elect? 800-743-9576. Let me go to Adam in Miami Beach. Adam, thanks so much.
Congratulations, Congresswoman Shalala. I saw you at an open house, and I was very impressed by your campaign. I think it was really great that you were sticking with education, jobs, healthcare that affect all Americans, and affect especially Democrats, Republicans, that affect the people at the kitchen table. I just wanted to ask or let you know that I hope that that I understand investigations and stuff are important, but I think what the American people care about are the issues that you emphasize. And particularly when we can see the issues with health care that even President Trump felt compelled to say we need to lower the price of prescription drugs and so forth. Let's make that the first one.
Yeah, I think Adam's making a very good point.
Prescription drugs.
Okay, yeah. Adam, thank you so much.
Adam's making a very good point, and that is, are we going to simply spend our time trying to impeach Donald Trump or oversight investigations? We have to do some oversight. Part of the responsibility, particularly of the majority now, is to make sure we do oversight on government, hold government accountable. It's not just Donald Trump. It's holding government accountable, every single one of those agencies. Sure, there are going to be hearings, but all of us have the same view. We want to get something done for the people in our districts. And boy, the freshman class is really ready to go.
And he's talking about health care, but specifically prescription drug costs.
Exactly.
How do you tackle this?
Well, there are a number of things that we need to do. The administration, by the way, wants to do a bipartisan bill. And I think we should take them up on that if we can reach agreement, not around the edges, but really driving down prescription drug costs. One of the things I talked about in the campaign is we've got 41 million people in Medicare. We ought to be able to negotiate prescription drug costs with the pharmaceuticals on the basis of having that kind of volume. That was precluded when they debated the Affordable Care Act from letting Medicare do that. We've never been able to do that. That's one way to do it because we can get lower prices for everyone. The second thing we could do, we could simply take what the VA already negotiates, take their list of their costs of prescription drugs and just simply adopt it for all of the government programs. Those are the simplest ways to do it. Let me assure you, we're in government. They'll probably figure out something more complex.
But the other question too is this. I mean, now Democrats have the House, but do you see an opportunity for bipartisan work on this or pushback from the Senate and the president?
No, I do see a chance for bipartisan because it's an American issue. Everybody that has health care is concerned about the cost of drugs, and everybody knows someone who can't afford their drugs. So I actually think it's more than bipartisan. It's all of us. Same thing for pre-existing conditions. You don't have health insurance if you're not covering anything that might happen to you. And that's exactly what we're talking about when we're talking about pre-existing conditions. What you can't predict for the future, what you have now. It ought to be all medically necessary services. And we've got to protect pre-existing condition protections and insurance.
Interesting. You brought up also is and you've heard it from people that now Democrats have the House, that there is going to be more pushback against the president. There is House Resolution 1 right now. It's an anti-corruption bill. not likely to get far with the Senate and the president, but it tries to tackle a couple of different things. Again, more on investigation. One part of it is on making sure politicians disclose their tax returns. Probably doesn't have any legs, but what do you think about, just even this push right now?
We absolutely should do that. There has to be disclosure. This is all about transparency. If you want to be in office, there ought to be a set of rules that you follow, and people ought to know everything about your finances. You also ought not to be able to sit on public boards. That exclusion should not exist for members of Congress. And I think the Democrats are going to have a whole anti-corruption, the first bill that was introduced. Most of it is just transparency and restricting what you can and can't do as a member of Congress.
Again, the number is 800-743-9576. Again, you can also tweet us or Facebook a question at WLRN Sundial. Part of this is going to go on really the leadership of the House, and Nancy Pelosi nominated this, again, vote coming later in January, nominated for the next House Speaker. But there are Democrats who have said, no, we want new leadership. We're looking for a new voice. Do you see this being a contentious issue, or is this pretty much set?
It's pretty much set. And it's not contentious because the handful of people who have said that have not put anyone forward. So you can talk about new voices. So show me the new voice. And I've had conversations with some of those people that are arguing for new voices. I said, so tell me who the new voice is. What are the new issues that Speaker Pelosi has said that she won't deal with that you want to have dealt with? And no one can answer that question. So I think she's been an outstanding leader. She got us this far. I've known her for years, years and years. I testified before her for 8 years straight. She was on the Appropriations Committee when I was Secretary of Health and Human Services. She's shrewd. She's tough. She got us the Affordable Care Act, even when the president was not so sure he wanted to push it forward. I'm happy to support her, as is my colleague, Debbie Mascaro-Powell.
All right, let's go to the phones again. I want to go to Paul, who's in Delray Beach. Paul, thank you for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Yes, hi. My question is, I teach at three community colleges in South Florida. The Florida State Legislature tried to push legislation where students would be armed, could come to campus armed. Is there anything to be done at the national level to prevent students from coming to college armed?
All right, Paul, thank you for the call. This has been around not just since Parkland. This conversation, actually, there was a big debate in Texas some years back on college campuses, if not just staff, but even students could be armed. But, I mean, on a national scale, you've seen where the gun debate has gone here in Tallahassee. Mm-hmm. What happens next?
Well, actually, in Tallahassee, the gun debate was stopped. The idea of allowing people to be armed on college campuses was basically stopped. And who was it stopped by? John Thrasher, the president of FSU, who had been head of the Republican Party in the state, who said, no way we're going to allow students on campus here to have guns. And I agree with that. Are there things you could do at the federal level? Maybe. The question is, would it get through the Senate? I'd have to think about it. There are some answers that I don't readily have. I wonder if you could attach federal aid to not having guns on campus. I mean, there are some background things. I don't think that's what we're going to do. I think we're going to try to get the background check through. I think we're going to have a debate on assault weapon ban. And on the issue of carrying guns on campus, that probably is going to remain at the states. I have not seen that on a federal list of things that we should do. But I'm very proud of the leaders of the campuses here in the state who said, absolutely not. We absolutely do not want that law.
Again, talking with Congresswoman-elect Donna Shalala from District 27, and we're taking your calls, your thoughts, your questions, as she's and the new elected leaders will be taking office in January. What are some of the issues that you hope they're going to be tackling? Again, the House was flipped to Democrat, but what happens next when you have a Senate run by the Republicans and a president? Will they work together to get things done? 800-743-9576. Let's look at the issue of immigration. Of course, the thing that even before the election was the conversation about this thousands of people moving through Central America and arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border. A couple thousand have voluntarily turned back and left. Mexico now, Mexico's newly elected president has said that he's going to be moving people to a government encampment away from the border. Of course, there was the debate about, you know, guards pepper spraying people seeking asylum. Your take on this issue and really focusing on is the system we have for asylum seekers need to be reconsidered? Do we need to fix it?
Of course we need to fix it, but the way to fix it is to get more judges down there and to make investments in the countries that people are fleeing. They're fleeing those countries because they're unsafe. They're fleeing those countries because economically it's a disaster. Our investments in Central America and in Latin America are particularly important. If the economies are good in those places, if people are safe in their homes, they don't start walking towards the American border. So that we have to do two things. And the president has to stop withdrawing aid from countries in Central America in particular. So we have to keep investing in strengthening law enforcement in those countries as well as in their economies.
And one of the tricky parts, though, is, you know, when we talk about aid to some of these countries, talk about, you know, Nicaragua and, El Salvador, some of these the challenges is that you've got countries where the leadership is questionable and you have gangs that are really running a lot of local governments. So, I mean, how do you deal with the issue of aid to countries when you don't even have confidence in the leadership of those countries? Because, well, what are they going to do with our money?
That's the challenge. And in fact, one of the things I said in the campaign is that I would extend TPS to Nicaraguans and to Venezuelans in particular. And I approached the chairman of the Judiciary Committee that has jurisdiction on that area to start a conversation to see how much interest there is and see how much I can push them to take a hard look. It's hard to do. But one of the reasons those governments got so screwed up was that we weren't making those kinds of investments. But humanitarian aid is critical. And finding people who believe in the rule of law in some of these countries and simultaneously investing in their economies is something that we have to do, or we're not going to be able to handle the border crisis.
And you talk about TPS, temporary protected status. The president ended it for Haitians, for El Salvadorians, for a number of different groups here in the United States. And all of those are going to be ending soon. We're talking about tens of thousands of people here in South Florida.
But the courts have delayed that decision.
Yes. But as you hit Congress, how do you approach this issue? Can you convince the president to change his mind? He believes, the government believes, those countries are safe to go back to. And we've already seen in a lot of the cases, no, they're not.
Yeah. Well, this is going to require Congress paying attention to this issue. Obviously, there's an executive order here, but Congress can pay attention to the issue. And those of us from South Florida are very focused on the extension of TPS for all of the groups that are involved and new extensions for Venezuelan and Nicaraguans in particular. So we're going to have to push the Senate and the president to recognize that it makes no sense not to extend TPS to these groups. They're behaving as good citizens in our country. They're working every day. They're taking care of their families. They're contributing to our economy. But that leads you to the broader discussion of immigration. And immigration in particular, we've got to find a compromise here where there's a pathway to citizenship. We've got too many people in this country that whose status is questionable. And they're undocumented. They're not registering their American-born children for health insurance, which they're eligible for. And they're fearful every day And they, many of them have been here for a very long period of time, for 20 years. We've got to find a pathway to citizenship for them.
Let me go back to the phones. I'm going to go to Albert in Kendall. Albert, thank you for waiting. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hi, Albert.
Dr. Shalala, it occurs to me that there are a couple times that you've had the chance to choose different places to live, different places to be. And obviously, you made a decision to come to the University of Miami. And then I'm supposing you had the chance to decide to go somewhere else after that. Yet you stayed. What was it at first that brought you to Miami? What spoke to you in Miami? And what is it that kept you there afterwards?
That's an interesting question. Let me try to answer it quickly. First of all, my family, my mother's side of the family, has been in South Florida, in this district in particular, since the 1940s. So my grandparents, my aunts and uncles, my cousins, most recently, my Cuban cousins have come over, and they live in South Florida. Like many Lebanese, I have cousins all over Latin America who often come here to live. I think I was attracted first by the job, the opportunity to take the University of Miami to another level. I've always loved Miami and South Florida. As a child, I came here all the time with my parents, particularly during the holidays. And I adored my grandparents who lived down here. So the opportunity to come home, in a sense, and to a place where my cousins were and my aunts and uncles had lived was too good of an opportunity. And when I was looking at jobs, I particularly wanted a private university. I had run two public ones. And then, frankly, I fell in love with South Florida, with its diversity, with its energy. Leading the University of Miami was a lot of fun, and I fell in love with the community and decided I would stay. Yes, I had lots of opportunities. And in fact, everybody said to me, well, are you moving to Washington? I said, only a couple of days when I have to be there, and I'm going to fly right back to Miami.
I wanted to ask you about recently move over to the topic to climate change issues. And obviously the White House report came out, the fourth national climate change assessment. And some Republicans are pushing it aside, claiming that it's fatalistic. Some of them, including, and this was a recent story you've commented on, House and Senate leaders from Wyoming, and you called them deniers. But look, how do we move forward on this? Do you think you have to convince some of the folks like from some of these states that it is an issue we need to pay attention to? Or is it just, look, if you're not going to believe it, we're just going to get the votes and we got to push whatever legislation is necessary?
I think all of the above. First of all, there are no climate deniers in South Florida. There are no Republicans in South Florida that believe that climate change isn't a life or death issue for us, that sea level rise isn't, and dealing with it isn't critical, whether it's building walls, seawalls or pumps, or we've got to make the investments in the Everglades that'll give us and in clean water. So those investments, I hope, will be part of the infrastructure bill. I've always had the philosophy in politics that you don't have to change everybody's minds, but you do have to build coalitions and convince people that this is a priority for the country. And we just have to keep working at that. And the fact that it's bipartisan down here, I think, is helpful to us as we talk to people around the country.
But do you have to convince the president's mind?
We may not have to if we have an overwhelming vote. And 2 years from now, I hope we'll have a shot at electing a president who believes in climate change, believes it's really here, and is committed to the environment.
Let me go to the phones one more time here. I got Larry in Fort Lauderdale. Larry, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks very much, Congressman-elect. Good to talk to you. I was at the Dolphins game yesterday, and, you know, it just sort of epitomized to me some of the transportation challenges that we're facing down here. You know, the turnpike was closed getting out of there, and virtually everybody who went to the game was, you know, driving in their own vehicles. And I guess I'm just curious what you think could be done at the federal level to steer more dollars to public transportation needs down in South Florida. And also wanted to mention that I'm the husband of a University of Miami grad. So thanks for that.
Well,
Larry, thank you so much.
Larry, say hello to her for me. The infrastructure bill, I hope, will include both an investment in public transit we've got a smart plan here. We ought to be funding it, as well as dealing with our environmental challenges. That's what we need in South Florida. And one of the things I've said to the leaders of the Transportation Committee and to my colleagues that are going to be on that committee, I don't know whether I'll be on that committee or not, is that we need the flexibility in every community to deal with our priorities. Our priorities are transportation. I've already started conversations with people. You know, we just need, if we just got the lights synchronized in this community, so you could just drive through, that would make a big difference for all of us. But there are lots of investments we need to make. We have a strategy, but we have to fund it, and we have to get some of our money back. This isn't a matter of expanding the federal deficit. This is getting our money back to spend on our priorities.
Let me finish with this. There's so many things to cover, but, you know, we'll get you back in. This was a record year for women in politics, not just on state levels, but obviously in Congress. How do you think that's going to help shape, you know, the next couple of years when it comes to debates, the legislation that has to pass, you know, the conversation about governance? What changes?
There are no dreamers among the women that have been elected. They want to get things done. And if you want to meet the most pragmatic people in Congress, come and meet the women who have just been elected and those that have already been there. When you talk about kitchen table issues, and I don't mean to make a sexist remark about that, but just knowing women who have been elected to office, they're very focused on getting things done in their community that makes a difference for families, whether it's middle class tax cuts or whether it's transportation or whether it's the quality of education or the quality of health care. It is the most focused group.
It has been such a pleasure. And as always, you know, the invitation's open. Love to have you back, especially after you take office. We want to see what's going on.
Well, it'd be nice so that you don't have to add the elect on in introducing me.
Well, I have to for now. It's Congresswoman-elect Donna Shalala from District 27. Ms. Shalala, thank you so much.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Just a reminder, I wanted to let everybody know that tomorrow on Sundial, we're going to be announcing a special project for the Sundial Book Club for December. So find us on Facebook. Ask to join the group. We're going to make that announcement tomorrow. But still to come, Amendment 4 passed overwhelmingly. That's the amendment, again, that allows former felons in Florida the right to vote. But what happens next? What are the challenges they're going to be facing? We're going to talk about that next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. In November, Florida voters passed Amendment 4. This was one of the 12 amendments that received the most national coverage this midterm election cycle. It was supported by many people of color, celebrities including like singer Rihanna, John Legend, actress Gina Rodriguez, Eva Longoria, and Jesse Williams, just to name a few. It was part of the coverage of many late-night talk shows, like The Daily Show with Trevor Noah and Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. Essentially, the amendment would automatically restore and grant voting rights to over a million people across the state with felony convictions. The big question now, of course, is how will Amendment 4 get implemented? WLRN reporter Daniel Rivero has been following the coverage given to this constitutional amendment from the start, and he's going to help us understand what happens next. Danny, a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So what does this amendment, when does it go into effect officially?
On paper, Amendment 4 goes into effect on January 8th, which is also the day of the inauguration of the incoming governor and different cabinet members.
And remind everybody why it was such a big deal for this one to pass.
This is, by some measures, or actually, to quote someone, Howard Simon, the executive director of the ACLU of Florida, he calls this the largest extension of voting rights in American history since 1920, since women basically got the right to vote. We're talking about over a million, by some estimates, up to 1.5 million Floridians will now have the ability to vote. So this has the possibility to completely reshape the access to the polls in the state.
And it's not, by the way, it's not all former felons.
Not all former felons.
I mean, there are certain people that won't.
Yes, there's basically going to be two categories of felons now, which the state has to figure out how to do that part of it. But anyone convicted of a murder or of a sex offense or a sex crime, if you're a registered sex offender, you will not have automatic vote restoration. If you were convicted of a murder.
But as you said, you know, we're talking over a million people who are likely to be able to register to vote. I mean, how is this going to be implemented? Just once we get to January, go ahead. Now you can register.
So this is what I've been looking into, and there's not a lot of agreement on what happens now. It's clear that it goes into effect on January 8th. I've been calling people and asking them, okay, well, what are you doing? Are you planning ahead of how to implement this? And there's different thoughts on it. So the ACLU, the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, groups that really push this, they're of the mind that this is automatically implemented. This is what they call self-executing, that on January 8th, you'll be able to walk into somewhere and you'll be able to register. If you were a convicted felon and you served your time, you paid your restitution, you will simply be able to register.
This is self-executing, so there isn't somebody who's in charge of executing the amendment?
Well, according to these groups, which drafted this, and they drafted this over a long process, and they say they wrote it in a way to say that there is no room for the legislature, there's no room for the cabinet in order to have to implement some policy. The amendment reads, the rights shall be restored. So by this interpretation, on the 8th, if you fall under one of these categories, you can just go and you can register, and they have no reason to turn you away.
And you talked with Republican State Senator Dennis Baxley. He's the chair of the Senate's Ethics and Elections Committee, and this is what he says.
My paramount concern is that there is a clear system of validating that is uniform across the state for all the supervisors of election to know that we're all doing it the same way and that we all understand what needs to happen for someone to get validated.
Basically, I mean, I'm wondering if politicians or legislators or supervisors of elections, if they've received any guidance or direction on what they're supposed to do with this.
So this is where the messaging gets a little bit mixed, because I've called different people from all across the state, different state agencies, different legislators, as well as local county supervisor of elections to figure out if they have any guidance. And every supervisor of elections that I called, from Monroe County to Leon County and a lot of places in between, Miami-Dade and Palm Beach included, say they have no idea how they're going to actually go about implementing this. Now, I did talk to several state agencies that have somewhat of a role to play in this process, like the Florida Commission of Offender Review. They told me that this might require some implementing legislation from the legislature. The Florida Department of Corrections told me it's reviewing its protocols and policies. And the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, which keeps the criminal justice databases that underpins a lot of this verification, that if you register to vote, okay, have you served your time? Have you had your rights restored, etc.? They told me that this is going to require some legislative implementation.
Again, I'm talking with WLRN reporter Danny Rivera, and we're talking about Amendment 4, passed overwhelmingly by the voters of Florida. But can felons, former felons, not all of them, some of them, get the right to vote back immediately? How is this going to be implemented? How will this be rolled out? How are activist groups making sure that this is going to happen?
So I have posed the question to some activist groups. The way it's been put to me is that they're taking it one step at a time. I was told by some people on the 8th, they will be going and they will be registering to vote. And the kind of unspoken second part of that sentence is that if there's any issues, they'll take it from there. Now, I have received the indication that there might be issues, because there is not clarity at this point as to whether this will be ready to go. I mean, if you have the state agency saying they're going to have to implement legislation, the legislature doesn't meet until 2 months later. So even if it's a temporary gap, there are local elections in some municipalities across the state that happen in February. So if you registered to vote on January 8th or in the early days, you'd be able to vote in those elections. So something's going to happen.
Real quickly, I wrap with this, is that this week, the Florida State Association of Supervisors of Elections is meeting in Sarasota. I'd imagine this has got to be top of the list, right? I mean, what do you think is going to happen there?
So I have the agenda of this meeting. It's not explicitly on there, but I will say that there is the director of the Division of Elections is going to be speaking, and I was told by several county administrators that they hope that this is brought up. They might bring it up themselves if the state doesn't bring it up, because it's on a lot of people's radar. Quickly about the... So in federal courts, this question of the process of how do you restore someone's rights has been the Rick Scott's administration has an open lawsuit in the federal appeals court in Atlanta about this. The state has said that this question of restoring rights is purely up to the cabinet and to the governor. So if the legislature does get involved, it would actually be contradictory to the state's own position. Because the state says this is only the executive branch. So if the legislature does get involved, that could set up some kind of a potential lawsuit or questions about the separation of powers and how these things are executed.
And again, the voters said this is what they want, but does it work that easily? WLRN's reporter Danny Rivera all over this issue on Amendment 4. Danny, it's always a pleasure, man.
Thank you for having me.
And again, something that we'll keep our eyes on, we'll keep following. Well, still to come, it's time for another season of Miami Art Week in Art Basel. We're going to give you the go-to guide for the festivities, all coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, tens of thousands of art lovers from around the world will be descending upon Miami Beach beginning Thursday for the start of Art Basel. The yearly event attracts some of the top artists, galleries, and connoisseurs to South Florida for presentations, events, and, of course, plenty of purchasing. But Basel is only for the art elites, or is it? Wait a minute, is it? And what about all the other events happening around the city of Miami during Miami Art Week? Brett Sokol is the arts editor at Ocean Drive Magazine, a contributing writer on art and culture for the New York Times, and the co-founder of Letter 16 Press. And he's here to answer your questions. So if you've got a question about Art Basel or Miami Art Week, you've never been, give us a call, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. Brett, always a pleasure, man. How you doing?
It's great to be here. I should just, fair warning to our listeners, there's something called the Basel flu strikes every year, and I seem to have gotten it somehow before Art Basel even started. So
all right,
we're going to power through.
Let's start with something, man. I just said Basel. You said Basel. What is it?
Oh, dear Lord.
Let's start with that. What is it really? I'm not saying it wrong.
It comes from the town in Switzerland where the fair, the sort of the mothership, originally started, and I'm probably Americanizing Art Basel.
That's all right. Well, it's you and a lot of other people. It's okay. Talking about the history of this event, I mean, how did it end up in Miami of all places?
Well, at some point in the late 90s, by that point, the main fair in Switzerland had become this huge phenomenon, sort of like the main show for the contemporary art world. And they decided that they wanted to expand and have a fair in the United States. And it was kind of like the equivalent of Amazon saying we're going to open a second headquarters. People started scrambling to sort of see what city it was going to land in. And the art collectors and the city of Miami Beach went into a full court press. They flew over, met with the fair people, and they basically said, not only do we have a burgeoning art scene, which we did at that time, nothing like today, but we'll essentially give you everything but our firstborn children if you come here. And they were able to convince the fair that Miami Beach was the place to do it. The first one was supposed to happen in 2001. It was canceled at the last minute because in the wake of 9/11, nobody was flying. Insurance costs were astronomical. So 2002 was the very first one, and it has now been happening every December since then. And obviously, if anyone has tried to drive in Miami during this upcoming week, they know that it is a huge event.
I know. How did it go from being just this weekend thing now to, like, you know, you've got events going out throughout the week? How did it grow?
It started out fairly modest. And one of the things that I think is important to note is there is a fair called Art Basel, and it takes place at the Miami Beach Convention Center. And then there are all of these other things going on that have nothing to do with the fair. There are satellite fairs, there's gallery openings and museum shows, and I mean, everyone and everything puts on their best art face.
But they want to link themselves to.
Right, whether the Art Basel Fair likes it or not. And so I think, you know, I discovered this at one point when in the sort of, you know, mid-aughts, once the fair had become this phenomenon and you had lots of people coming down here without a real connection to the art world. And I was at this fairly swanky dinner trying to, you know, do some intelligence gathering. And, you know, I met these people who looked like what you would expect well-heeled art collectors to look like coming down from Miami, you know. And I started talking to them and I said, well, what did you see at the convention center? It was the first opening, sort of the VIP opening day is Wednesday. It opens to the public Thursday, but it was Wednesday night. And, you know, I said, what did you all see at the convention center that really impressed you? And they looked at me like I was insane. They said, convention center? Why would we fly from New York City to Miami to go to a convention center? And I said, but that's where the art is. And again, they're like, what are you talking about? They came to Miami for the parties, for the dinners, the parties, to sit by the pool and all of that. And that aspect of it has just exploded now, where there's a portion of the art world for whom Art Basel is spring break. And then there's just a portion of the larger culture for whom it's just spring break period in December. There are very little, it's sort of a slightly more sophisticated version of spring break.
All right. Well, spring break, I was going to say Art Basel, Art Basel is starting up. Also Miami Art Week too. Let's talk about that. But we'd love to hear your thoughts. Have you ever been? If you want to go, what's the question you have about what you should do, how you should approach this week, et cetera, et cetera. Give us a call, 800-743-9576. And if you've gone in the past, let us know your thoughts and, you know, kind of like how you experienced it. And, you know, how do you explain to somebody if they've never gone how they should try to experience it? 800-743-9576. Clarify the difference, by the way, between Art Basel and Miami Art Week so people know.
Miami Art Week is simply, I hate to dismiss a lot, but it's just a promotional name that some folks slapped on, mainly sort of Chamber of Commerce types, to sort of promote all these other events that aren't necessarily part of Art Basel. So it's an easy catch-all for everything that's happening this week. And there is an insane amount of things happening. And I would just sort of say, just to kick things off, people say, well, what should we see? What should we not miss? If you do nothing else, at least go to the actual Art Basel Fair. Opens to the public Thursday afternoon, all day Friday, Saturday, Sunday. It's at the Convention Center on Miami Beach. I have to say the ticket prices are getting a little crazy. It's up to $50 a head now. But I would see it as a very expensive museum show. You're really going to get an excellent snapshot of what's happening in the contemporary art world today. The good, the bad, and the aesthetically ugly. It's all there under one roof.
And the other thing, too, is that, you know, how much of that art that's there is local or regional, and how much of it is just artists from all around the world coming to show themselves off?
Well, this has been a perennial complaint on the part of a lot of people in the Miami art world, and some of it's justified, that this huge event comes and it sets up in our backyard, and how much does the Miami art scene, do Miami artists benefit from it? I would say quite a lot in the early years of the fair, not as much now. And I don't know if it's so much the fault of the art fair, even though there are only two Miami galleries in the entire fair, but it's simply because there's so much happening now that you've got people who come in for the fair and they're really just not either taking the time or have the ability to take the time to kind of dig into a lot of the homegrown stuff.
Is there any pressure, though, to get at least some kind of local art into the main fair? You know, are there any requirements, or it's just, well, no.
It's a privately run organization. Do people complain? Yes. Do the organizers of the fair care? No. They would say that they're, and again, this is within the art world itself, this is no subject of, there's no small controversy around this, because the people deciding who gets into the fair, which is basically an excuse to print money once you're in, are other galleries who are essentially your competitors. And as much as you know, dealers in the art world will tell you that it's we're all friends and we all work together. It's a business and it's a competitive one.
All right. So how do you describe to somebody who's never been? I mean, because you already mentioned prices are starting to go up. How do you explain like what that experience is going to be like for somebody? Why go? If you're not buying.
It's a great opportunity to see a huge cross-section of contemporary art as well as some really amazing older pieces all under one roof. There is no museum show in Miami like it or that will ever be like it. I mean, you'll get to see both cutting edge work where the paint is still not dry. You'll see works that maybe you've only seen in books, whether it's, you know, some amazing Basquiat's coming up for sale. You know, there's even a lot of older abstract expressionist work that's coming back. There's, you know, in the past years, we've seen some gorgeous Helen Frankenthalers and some Rothkos that never make it to museums anywhere in South Florida. So if you are a lover of art, old or new, it's definitely worth, again, I'm not going to make an excuse for the $50 ticket price. To me, that's just insane. But I would see it as an amazing, if overpriced, museum show that you should definitely check out.
What is what's the big thing that you're looking forward to for this upcoming Art Basel?
I would say, as someone who's based here in Miami, I'm looking forward to seeing new work that I know nothing about. So when you walk down the aisles of the Art Basel Fair, and there each gallery has a booth set up. And what I'm looking for is what I didn't know I was looking for. The work that stops me cold and makes me go, what is that? I want to know more. I want to know who made it. Where did this come from? How did this come into being? And without fail, there's always a couple instances of those that happen every year that make me shed my cynicism and all of my sort of snarkiness about the art world and just go, wow, this is some amazing work. I'm so glad I got a chance to see it in person, not on a screen, but up close.
You talked about how Miami won over the opportunity to host this because there was this, you know, growing art scene. But where is the art scene now in Miami? What's happening right now?
You know, I would say we're sort of in a period of flux, in a sense. Let me back up. There's always been amazing art being made by really talented artists in Miami, going back to the late 1960s. I mean, in the 60s and 70s, you had really talented artists, Robert Teeley, sculptor, still going strong, Charles Hashem, a photographer doing amazing work, the late Bob Huff, a painter, Lynn Gelfman came up in the 70s. She's got a show at PAM that's really, really amazing. In the 80s, guys like Robert Chambers started making a name for themselves. In the 90s, Dara Friedman, her husband Mark Hanforth. What Miami didn't have was an art market. There really wasn't a way for these artists to make a living as an artist. They kind of had two choices. They could either get a teaching job to pay the rent, or they could get a U-Haul and move to New York. I mean, that really was, those were the two options. And Art Basel changed that in a very big way by shining this spotlight of attention on the Miami art scene, on Miami artists. So you had suddenly collectors from New York and LA and Berlin and London looking at Miami artists. And you had a lot of people in Miami getting newly excited about buying art by Miami artists. And so Basel really caused this explosion in creating a homegrown art market. That's cooled down a little bit. And so we're in this period now where local sales aren't quite what they once were in the initial wake of Art Basel. For a couple of years, you had a lot of Miami artists who were getting a little despondent about that and moving to L.A. We're sort of in a in-between period, and I'm interested to see how it all shakes out.
Real quickly, in 30 seconds, tell me, outside of the big fair, though, what else do you think people should go check out?
Don't sleep on a lot of our local galleries. This is, you know, even though these galleries are here year-round and the Miami art scene is a year-round phenomenon, it's not just a week in December, everybody puts their best face on for Basel. They want to impress the world when everybody's looking. So I would say, first of all, there's a huge number of great galleries that are all in Little Haiti and Little River. The Emerson Dorsch Gallery has a group show of a lot of the artists that they work with. The Primary Gallery has a great show by Carlos Betancourt in the Design District. Pan-American Art Projects and Tile Blush. Again, go to Little Haiti, Little River, lots of great galleries.
Brett Zuckel again, arts editor at Ocean Drive Magazine, contributing writer on art and culture for the New York Times and co-founder of Letters 16 Press. Brett, as always, a pleasure, man. Keep the flu on that side, though.
Thank you.
That's the program for today. I'm Luis Hernandez. Coming up tomorrow, Fort Lauderdale taking drastic approaches to combating homelessness. We're going to talk with the city commissioner about that. Also, we're going to be talking more Art Basel, Art Basel, however it's said, on the program tomorrow. Remember to find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Also, big announcement coming up tomorrow on the Sundial Book Club. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great day. Talk to you tomorrow.